Welcome to the Fresh Heart Project. My name is Zareen. I am a consultant cardiologist and your host. This is the last episode of this current season, and what an episode. I was delighted to sit down with Dr. Kimberly Sadler, general practitioner, sports fanatic, triathlete, and an all-round champion role model. In her late 20s, Kimberly developed a heart rhythm abnormality called atrial fibrillation, or AF. As a GP, the AF gave her a unique insight into the patient journey. She talks openly about how it affected her exercise tolerance and how she got back into training. We are so grateful to Kimberly for sharing her story.
Oh, Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us on the Fresh Heart Podcast. I'm delighted to welcome you today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be on.
Oh, now I've been following you on social media for a while, and there are so many wonderful things on your social media that we will touch upon and talk about. But I want to say thank you for sharing that mango lassi recipe. Do you know, I looked at it and it really took me back to my childhood of being in Pakistan with family, enjoying a bit of mango lassi, laughing, and you know, just being relaxed and in a happy place. So thank you. So for anyone who doesn't know, mango lassi is like a mango flavored yogurt based drink. So for anyone listening, get that recipe. If you like yogurt and yogurt based drinks, then it's a winner. So now coming on to you, Kimberly. Now, I want to start by talking about the importance of sport in your life growing up. So how important was sport?
So I come from quite a sporty family. So my dad used to run marathons and my mum's a swimmer. And I've got a sporty brother and a sporty sister. So we were always sort of outdoors being active. And at school, I just played everything. I loved to run. Went to swimming classes, and I think quite early on just realised I loved being in the water, probably because of mum, really. I think she really was encouraging in terms of that side of things. And when I sort of was about 12, 13, things really started to take off. So I started training more and started competing and loved it. And then since then, just been carrying on being sort of active and trying to keep healthy.
And you competed nationally, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. So I think it was when I was either 14 and 15 or 15 and 16. I can't quite remember now. I qualified for some butterfly events at the Nationals. So yeah, swam nationally, which is fantastic.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. And that continued through university as well, didn't it?
Yeah. So I gave up swimming for a variety of reasons. So I gave up when I was about 17, 18, just because I was struggling a bit with my A-levels. And obviously wanting to do medicine, you sort of need pretty much straight A's. So I stopped because I just found I couldn't do it to the level I was doing it before. It was just better to sort of completely stop it. So at university, I played team sports. So I played for the university netball team. And I also played for the medics hockey team. And then when I qualified as a junior doctor, I just found it really hard to play team sport just because of all the shifts and rotas and things. So it was a nightmare to try and actually make matches or make training. And that's when I sort of took up triathlon instead.
And did you find that triathlon fit nicer or easier within your rota and schedules?
Well, I think the thing with triathlon is it's reasonably sort of individual. So it's an individual sport. So if I had a run of nights, I could not train during the nights and then make it up at the weekend and train, you know, if I had 30 minutes to get a quick run in or go for a, you know, go on the turbo, that just was much easier to fit into my life rather than sort of having to make, you know, matches at a specific time or training at a specific time.
Yeah. And did you enjoy that just as much? Is there something that you miss about the team aspect?
Yeah, so I mean, I love team sport, and I miss sort of playing. I really miss playing netball, to be honest. It's just really good camaraderie. But now I'm a member of a swimming club, and it's like being in a team there. I know swimming's an individual sport, but we do relays as well as sort of train together. And now I'm a bit more set on my working week being a GP. It's much easier to make specific training sessions. So I've got a bit of both now, which is nice.
That's lovely. And now the reason why I invited you onto this podcast is to talk about what happened in your late 20s, which is the development of a condition called atrial fibrillation. So just for listeners who don't know and aren't aware of it, what is atrial fibrillation?
You're probably the best person to explain it than me. I mean, it's essentially an irregular and often sort of abnormally fast heart rate, which means that the heart just isn't pumping effectively, which gives rise to symptoms like palpitations, shortness of breath, dizziness and fatigue.
And that's very well described.
Thank you.
I often say that, yes, when your heart is beating normally, the top of the heart contracts nicely and the bottom of the heart follows. And in atrial fibrillation, what happens is that the top of the heart wobbles or twitches. Yes. And as a result, the impulses that are conducted are irregular and that they can often be very fast, and as a result, because your heart's beating so fast and erratically, cause symptoms such as breathlessness and fatigue and palpitations. Is that what you experienced? What happened when you first experienced it?
I mean, it was like someone turned on a light switch. So I had a very instant run of palpitations, which then just didn't go away. So mine happened in the middle of an out-of-hours shift. At work, so I just ignored it like a typical medic. Carried on, finished my shift, went home, tried to rest, drank loads of fluids, tried to do some Valsalva manoeuvres, but nothing seemed to sort of stop it. And I'd been in AF for about 12 hours, I think, before I went to the hospital. And by that point, I was just feeling a bit tired and a little bit dizzy, but it took a while for me to feel unwell with it.
Yeah. Did you have palpitations or was it just generally unwell and dizzy?
No, lots. I mean, the palpitations were horrible. I mean, my resting heart rate is sort of in the 40s. And my heart rate was about 90 to about 110. So it's almost double what it was normally. So I really felt it. It was horrible.
Yeah. And, you know, it's such a typical thing for us all to do that we think, oh, it'll settle. It's probably nothing. Yeah. It's, you know, we don't really need to worry about it. What initial feelings did you have? Did you know that it was AF or did you think that it could be this, being a GP?
Yeah, I think if I'm 100% honest with myself, I knew it was AF from the onset, but I think I tried to shrug it off a little bit and just tried to convince myself it wasn't, because I'm not a cardiologist, I'm a GP, and in a GP's world, a 29-year-old who's fit and active doesn't usually go into AF. So I didn't really believe it. And then obviously when I saw it on an ECG, I thought, well, I can't really pretend it's not AF anymore.
Absolutely. And how did that make you feel? Did you actually physically go into hospital and then be sort of connected up to all the monitors?
Yeah, so my sister's a nurse in the hospital locally. Hopefully I won't get into trouble for doing this, but she did an ECG on the ward for me because I didn't want to bother A&E. I didn't want to bother out of hours because I thought, it can't be AF. Why would it be AF? And she did an ECG, and when I could see it on the ECG, I said, well, I'm just going to have to walk down to A&E. So, self-presented to A&E with my ECGs and very quickly got put through to majors. So,
and how did that feel? On one minute, being on the other side, working a shift, helping patients, treating patients, seeing patients with all their issues, and then the next minute, the next day, you're on the other side. How did that feel?
Yeah, it was a real lesson in sort of humility. And I remember you had the podcast with Dr. Rupi and his experience with AF. And that was interesting as well to hear it from another sort of medic's perspective. I mean, no one made me feel uncomfortable. All the staff were really welcoming. But I think the overriding sensation was that of embarrassment and just general humiliation. It was very odd being on the other side of the curtain.
And there's a vulnerability that we're not used to as medics, aren't
yes.
we?
With it,
yeah. How did that land?
It's very odd. I mean, I'm used to being, well, particularly as a junior doctor, when you do your ward rounds, there's sort of about five doctors around one patient, isn't there, in the bed? And I was used to just being one in the background with writing the notes down. But it's actually really overwhelming as a patient to have five people all looking at you. It was overwhelming to be on the other side.
And what happened next? How did you get out of atrial fibrillation? What treatment did you have? What were the next steps?
So I had flecainide, so I had medical sort of cardioversion. But I think because I'd been in it for so long, it just, it didn't work. So I was in A&E for about 5 or 6 hours, I think, in the end. And when it hadn't worked, they had to admit me for an electrical cardioversion. But when I got to the ward, after about an hour, things had settled down. So I don't know if it was a timing thing or if it was something else. But yeah, eventually it stopped. So I managed to spare myself having the electrical cardioversion, which I was very grateful for. So maybe it was the threat of that that managed to sort of put me back into it. So yeah, things eventually settled.
Yeah. And just for listeners who don't know, a cardioversion is when we get you out of an abnormal heart rhythm, such as atrial fibrillation. And Kimberly's absolutely right. You can do it in lots of different ways. And sometimes we do start by trying medicines. And if these aren't successful, or if, you know, we can see that someone's not very well with it, then we consider doing what we call an electrical cardioversion, which is when we give you a mild general anaesthetic and then put the electrical defibrillator paddles on and just time a very well coordinated shock with your heartbeat to try and kickstart the heart and get it out of the abnormal heart rhythm. So you didn't have the electrical cardioversion, it all just sort of settled.
All thankfully settled down before I needed that.
Talk me through how you felt going home, knowing that you did have atrial fibrillation, that it had settled, but that there would then be further tests and that this is the start of a different chapter.
Yeah, I mean, it was very odd because I have asthma, but otherwise I'm a fit and active, well, at the time, 29-year-old. And it was odd to have a condition, I guess, that would impact on my life. I was thankful actually, so they managed to do sort of a bedside scan of my heart because I was terrified that I had some sort of cardiomyopathy then. When we realised it was there, I thought, oh no, I'm not going to be able to exercise. But they did a bedside scan, and I was told my heart looked okay, but that I needed a proper echocardiogram to confirm. So I just listened to the advice I was told, and then waited to see how things were. But it was really hard. I mean, I completely dropped my exercise tolerance, so it took about 6 to 8 weeks to sort of build up my fitness levels again.
Wow.
It was bizarre. Yeah.
And a cardiomyopathy, just for listeners again, it's a disorder of the heart muscle, and it can sometimes affect sporting careers. But then, I mean, in you having the atrial fibrillation with no underlying heart issue, how did it affect you at that point in time?
Well, I mean, I think the main thing for me is whenever I have an episode, it always impacts on my exercise tolerance. And I think there's definitely a huge psychological overlay because I don't think it's all heart related, although my cardiologist has reassured me that it's normal to drop your exercise tolerance after an episode of AF, because I thought it was all in my head. But I think it's that, you know, I was worried, I didn't want to push myself because I didn't want another episode of AF because it's horrible every time you go into it and I feel rubbish. So it was just that sort of interaction between, dropping your exercise tolerance, not wanting to push yourself, getting a little bit of fitness back, having another episode, sort of stepping back to where you were before. It was just a bit frustrating.
Absolutely. And were there any goals that you had set yourself from a sporting perspective before you went into AF that were affected?
Yeah, so I was really building up. So I'd started triathlon maybe a year or two before I went into atrial fibrillation. So I'd started with sort of the shorter distances. So they're called sprint distances. And I'd built myself up to sort of the half Ironman distance. And that was the aim for the year, was to really go hard on a half Ironman. But that's a lot of exercise. That's about six hours I thought I was aiming for, and the advice from the cardiologist was to not do any more than sort of 8 to 10 hours of exercise a week. So it's kind of hard to train for a long event when you're not allowed to do all that training, and I think the advice was to avoid prolonged sustained high intensity exercise, which obviously a long distance triathlon would be. So I sort of cancelled the events I had planned and just sort of took a backseat just to see how things would develop, really.
And with sport being such a big part of your life and almost, I think, sometimes when you have that, it's a bit of an outlet to a career in medicine where you do deal with very stressful things on a day-to-day yeah. basis, that you can then sort of release all your energy and excess emotions through different yeah. avenues. And for a lot of people, it is sport.
Yeah.
How did that affect you in that perspective?
I mean, it was tricky because, yeah, I use a lot of the emotional pent up energy I think you get from working in a healthcare setting. And I use that and I burn it all off when I exercise, and then I feel much better. I mean, nothing feels as bad after you've gone for a run or you've, you know, been for a swim or anything like that. So I think I was still trying to exercise, but just within sort of more restricted parameters, I guess. So I was still getting a bit of stress relief, but just not to the extent where I was improving on my training, I guess.
When along this journey did you set up your social media account to kind of convey these messages to other people? When did you make that move?
Yeah, it was quite late actually. So I think I've had AF now for about 3 years ish, and I think I guess like a lot of other people with lockdowns and trying to juggle working in a healthcare setting with a pandemic, I really felt like my training was struggling and I was struggling for a bit of motivation, and events kept getting cancelled and it was just a bit frustrating. And obviously I was waiting for my ablation, so I was balancing going into AF, bouncing back, sort of not really knowing where my fitness levels were. And I think I just got to a point where I thought, I've got to stop using the AF as an excuse to not do things. You know, I like triathlon. I particularly love swimming. If I want to do something, I'm just going to do it. And there's not going to be a, you know, I'm not good at this anymore because I've got AF. It's going to be, right, I've got AF. How good can I get with this problem? You know, I didn't want to feel restricted, or, you know, I like challenges, and I like rising to a challenge. So I just thought, you know, let's just see what we can do and not ignore the AF, but, you know, see what happens and put no pressure on from prior performances.
That must have been a difficult place to arrive to, though, because it does take quite some journey to get there, doesn't it, when your identity is quite tied up in being an athlete?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's hard, isn't it? Because we say, and one of the, my cardiologist kept calling me a triathlete, and I said, what? I'm not a triathlete. To me, a triathlete is someone who goes to the Olympics, who competes, you know, professionally. But I think it's made me realise that I think I've done a post about this recently, about how, you know, if you do triathlons, you're a triathlete. If you run, you're a runner. We shouldn't be sort of restricting and, like, you know, saying we're not these things when actually we are working towards these aims. You know,
it's a label, isn't it?
Yeah, like, well, I might not be a pro, but I still spend an awful lot of time of my life doing these things, so why not say, well, I'm a runner? Doesn't matter how fast or slow you are.
Yeah, I love that, and that does come across on your social media. No, it definitely does. And do you feel that through having atrial fibrillation, after you kind of came to terms with it, that helped you as a doctor and as a medic?
Yeah, I mean, I think GPs are, we just have a lot more teaching, I guess, based on communication. And I think maybe hospital doctors, I mean, you might be able to tell me, but I don't know how much communication you have compared to us. So I think we're always taught about how to, you know, not talk to the patient, let the patient express their ideas using various methods. And I think when I had my AF, particularly on the first time I was admitted, I just got told a lot of things at me. And there was no sort of opportunity for me to explain my side of the story, so I think it's definitely helped in terms of communication. I think there's no point talking to a patient, you really have to involve them in the discussions. So for example, one of the consultants said, well, you just must have loads of caffeinated energy drinks. And I said, well, no, I don't. But there became this fascination in being like, right, well, she just drinks too much caffeine. I'm like, well, actually, we haven't spoken about that. I haven't told you how much I drink caffeine wise. But there was no, I don't know, I think everything needs to be a bit more open and really sort of exploring sort of people's concerns and ideas, really.
And I think as a doctor, if you feel that, then I wonder how people who have very limited or little medical knowledge feel when they're told all sorts of information in one go that doesn't always sit and land. You can sort of understand why sometimes compliance is an issue, or people don't understand what you've said.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think being a medic, in my world, 29-year-olds who are fit and active don't go into atrial fibrillation. But in the cardiologist's world, that was clearly very normal because there was nothing about it that made them sort of on edge or anything like that. And I think really, you know, even if I give, you know, diagnosis of a migraine to a patient now, I think, well, how, you know, what's their understanding of that? Does that seem like a big deal to them? Because you just never really know where their understanding of it is.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. And you mentioned very briefly an ablation, didn't you?
Yes.
And you went on to have an ablation procedure. And just very briefly for listeners, that is a procedure where we try and actually just short circuit the abnormal heart rhythm. We pop a, go into a theatre setting, sterile environment, you clean the skin in the groin, pop a little tube or catheter in there that sits in the vein, and then we guide wires and catheters around to the heart. And the catheters have little electrodes at the tip that can detect the location of any abnormal heart rhythms. And then the ablation procedure is when you can actually destroy very, very small amounts of tissue to remove the trigger and short circuit the abnormal heart rhythm and stop the heart rhythm issue. That is a procedure that, you know, we do very regularly, we do very routinely, and we do do it in younger patients with atrial fibrillation such as yourself. And, you know, you're right, we come across it, but it's not that commonly seen in a general practice setting. How did you feel when the ablation procedure was firstly mentioned, and secondly, how did you feel when you were called for the procedure, when you actually got a date?
I mean, when it was mentioned at first, I'd only had the first episode, and I think they were keen to just see how I responded. I think we talked a lot about triggers that might have led up to that, and I think a lot of the discussion was about avoidance of triggers to see if that would make a difference. So I think at the start we hadn't really considered it, but when I kept getting sort of more episodes, and I tried to stay on the medication regularly, and I just felt rubbish. I felt very sort of fatigued and a bit pathetic, and that just wasn't really an option. So I think then when it was mentioned, I was quite not excited, but I was looking forward to feeling like, well, this is sort of more definitive. This is hopefully this is just going to put an end to it, and I can sort of move on with my life without this problem. So I was really excited to get a date, but obviously with COVID and everything being delayed, I was really, really fortunate that I eventually got the call up, because the waiting list is a long time in the UK anyway. So I'd been waiting for about 18 months, which isn't too bad, because the waiting list was a year before COVID. So I can't complain. The NHS has been brilliant to me.
Well, that is good to hear. And you did, I mean, you know, for listeners, I do want to, if you want more information, I would, you know, direct you to Kimberly's Instagram account, because you do talk about the procedure, and there is a picture of you, you know, I think, was it before or after the procedure, where you have your hospital gown on? What is it like putting on that hospital gown and waiting for a procedure? What was going through your head?
Oh, it's so weird, isn't it? It's just very weird. I mean, I kind of knew exactly what questions I was going to get asked. I knew that I would have to, you know, where I would be going. And even with all of that, it still felt overwhelming. And actually, when the cardiologist came to meet me in the cath lab before the start of the procedure, said, "You seem a bit nervous." I said, "Yes, I am a bit nervous." So yeah, I mean, for someone who isn't used to that sort of healthcare setting, I can imagine it would be hugely overwhelming, because it's just an awful lot of people at once.
Before the ablation, what was your impression of how your recovery would be?
I guess because I am so well, I thought it was, you know, a small incision in the groin, home on the same day. No issues, probably won't be able to do as much as I can, no heavy lifting for a couple of weeks. So I thought I'd be feeling fine. The recovery was a little bit slower than I anticipated it was going to be.
Yeah. And what about your recovery was the most surprising?
I think I hadn't anticipated how sore and bruised my groin was going to be. And I had both sides. So they put the catheter for the ablation procedure up one side, and I think they did something with a probe or something on the other side so they could look at it with ultrasound guidance. I don't really didn't really quite know. So I had a sore left groin, but a really, really sore right groin. And it was really bruised and swollen. And that just was sore for about a week or two. And yeah, the amount of ectopic, so the amount of extra beats and the amount of AF I had in the week after the procedure, I thought, oh no, it's worse.
Yeah. Oh.
But I think that I was reassured that was all very normal and it would all settle down. And it did. It was quite right. So I think, yeah. Yeah.
Good. And what about getting back on the track? How was that? How has that been after the ablation?
I mean, it's tricky. It's been a difficult balance. So I don't think there's a great deal of guidance, to be honest, because I think not that many young people have atrial fibrillation. So I think, and particularly people who are into sport. So it was a delicate balance of what I was being told by the cardiology team. But that wasn't really in much depth, I have to be honest. So all I got was don't let your heart rate go above 100 for 2 weeks. And then after that, just sort of see how you go. So I just used common sense.
Listen to your body.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and I did at the start, whenever I did do anything a bit harder. So whenever I tried a bit of jogging, that was when I would get lots of extra beats. So I thought, well, you know, that's my body's way of saying, don't do that. So I just kept it very low heart rate. And then when I started doing a bit more running, I was doing sort of short runs with sort of interspersed with lots of walking. But mostly I stuck to swimming just because having been a swimmer, that's my background. I know exactly how high my heart rate is going to be depending on, you know, how hard I'm working. So it was much easier, I think, for me to have the control in the pool. So I stuck to that and then gradually introduced everything else.
And I remember seeing a picture of you with your ablation scars in your groin.
Yes.
And I think that was a brilliant thing to do, actually, to say, look, this is me. This is what happens. You know, I didn't expect this, but I'm going to wear these scars because this is my journey. And it's not been easy and it's not been smooth. But I'm going to carry on trying to get back to a level of sport that I'm happy with. Is that kind of the thinking that you had when you showed those? Because I do think it's a wonderful thing for people to see because it, you know, it makes them feel less alone.
Yeah, I think that's the main idea of the account is to try and mostly let young people know that young people have heart problems too, and all of this is very normal, and not to feel alone. I mean, I feel, you know, it's, sometimes I think you've got to look at it in terms of, I was worried about putting it up because lots of people who I follow have had, you know, major heart surgery, so they're part of the zipper club, so they've got their big midline scar, and I thought, I'm going to look like such a wuss compared to these people with my small scars and my bruising. But I think it's just, you know, this is what happens after an ablation. It's all very normal. You know, I'm happy in my skin. But yeah, I think just an understanding of that's what happens, and not to be afraid to sort of try and push yourself a little bit.
Well, I think it was a wonderful post. And it Thank also you. Kind of leads me on to my next question, which is slightly changing angle a little bit, which is about women in sport, because I think there's always a perception of how a woman should look. Growing up, you know, we have this ingrained and things are changing, which I'm really, really pleased about. So there is a sort of ripple of change. But, you know, how was this growing up? Because, you know, women in sport don't always fit that traditional description of what we're supposed to look like and what we're supposed to wear. How has that played out in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I could talk about this for days, Aaron. So you're going to have to stop me at some point. I mean, I have no idea where this, you know, this perfect body image for a woman has come from. And it's something that's a real bugbear of mine, whether or not it's through, you know, even like Barbie dolls, celebrities, social media. But I think growing up, there was never an acceptance of an athletic female body, other than, I guess, Sporty Spice, who, you know. But I don't know, I think we've really got to be careful what message we're sending to young women, because I was so embarrassed. I had, you know, really strong swimmer shoulders, And I stick out like a sore thumb, even in, you know, my photos from my, you know, school netball, because I'm just, you can't miss me. I'd barely fit in the frame. And I think part of the reason of giving up swimming and avoiding it for so long was I was so embarrassed by my body. And trying to lose a swimmer's shoulders by not doing swimming. And, you know, why I felt like that, I don't really know. And I'm glad to say I'm totally happy with them now, really embracing the swimmer's shoulders. But yeah, I don't know where it comes from. And I think you're right. I think there has been a shift in towards a more sort of an athletic female frame being a more acceptable body image. And there's lots of celebrities, I think, who have done marvels, including people like Dina Asher-Smith. I think she's fantastic. And she's got a Dina Asher-Smith Barbie doll that's more athletically built. And she's actually on the cover of, I think it's the British Vogue this month, ahead of the Olympics. And she's really, I had a little look on her Instagram recently, and she was saying something like how she's happy that it showcases her muscles and her strength and her power. And I think that's a really good positive message to be sending out young girls that, you know, females play sport, we have stronger bodies, that's okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's the message you're sending out as well. So it, not only are you talking about your atrial fibrillation, but you're also talking about normalizing how we are. And, you know, just accepting people for the way that they look, and that if you don't fit that traditional body type, that's absolutely fine. I find that really sad that you wanted to, you know, you felt self-conscious in a swimsuit because of your shoulders. Did you talk to anyone about it at that time, or was there just wasn't really, well, from my perspective, when I was growing up, there weren't really many people that you could really open up to about this. Did you have anyone you talked to?
No, I mean, when I was swimming, I was surrounded by other strong women who were built like swimmers as well. So it wasn't so much of an issue. It was, I guess, more when I went to university and I'd stopped swimming that I sort of struggled to fit in. And, you know, girls always have these things. Well, if you pose with your arm this way, then it makes your arm look thinner. And it's bonkers. It's just completely bonkers. And it just shouldn't matter. You know, if you've got a normal body mass index, does it matter if you're athletic or you're, you know, you're slightly slimmer or you're more curvy? It just shouldn't matter. I don't know why it's become an issue.
Well, thank you for talking about this, and thank you for raising these issues, because it's really important that we open up these conversations, normalize and allow people to express themselves in any way, shape or form. So thank you. Is there any part of your journey that you think kind of stands out in any way?
Oh, that's a thinker. I guess probably the recovery from the ablation and sort of getting back to some sort of phase of normal is, I guess, because it's just so new to me. And sort of, do I still say that I have atrial fibrillation now I haven't had it and I've had my ablation? Or, you know, what can I start doing again? Because there's not a great deal of research or guidance, really. So when I had my sort of follow-up from the cardiologist, I said, you know, I know we spoke about doing 8 to 10 hours of exercise a week and no more. What's the evidence based for that now? Can I go back to doing more? And the answer is they just don't really know. So it's kind of a balance now, I guess, for me, in terms of working out where I see myself going in the next, what my next sort of venture should be, I guess.
And you're right, it is an evolving field. We don't always have the answers. And I think it's important, just as you said earlier on, to listen to your body and to have that degree of awareness that this is when I stop and this is now my limitation. And that's fine. I think you're definitely doing an amazing job of putting that message out there for others who are in similar situations. So I do encourage anyone who's going through a similar journey to look at Kimberly's accounts. And now, before we started recording, we actually touched on a very interesting issue, and that's the effect that remote consultations in hospitals and in general practice have had on picking up atrial fibrillation. Can you just expand on that for us?
So I guess a lot of people who have atrial fibrillation like me, it will be like a light switch moment where you get a sudden onset of palpitations or breathlessness and you end up seeking medical advice, and that's how it gets diagnosed. But for a lot of other people, atrial fibrillation is often picked up as sort of an incidental finding. So if I see someone who's short of breath, they book a GP appointment, they come in, they feel short of breath, we have a chat about their symptoms, and then I examine them. The first thing you do as a medic is look at the patient, but then you feel their pulse is usually the second thing you do. And that's where you pick up if someone has an irregular pulse. That can be something like atrial fibrillation. But obviously, because of the pandemic at the moment, a lot of us are doing telephone triage. So we're still restricting the numbers of people that can come in, mainly for social distancing reasons, just because there's too many people in the waiting room otherwise. And we can sort out a lot of problems over the phone, but ones that we can't, we are bringing in. But if I see someone over the phone with fatigue, say, and I don't necessarily think they need a face-to-face, I might organise some blood tests first. How many atrial fibrillations are we not picking up as sort of incidental findings? And I guess then how much of an impact is that long-term wise going to have on our healthcare system? So I've probably in my career, which has only been 3 years as a fully fledged GP, I've probably picked up on about 4 or 5 incidental atrial fibrillations. And since the pandemic, obviously it's been none because I don't sort of opportunistically feel people's pulses. And that has a huge impact because it really increases your chance of having a stroke. So I wonder, you know, where are these people going to be ending up? I guess we'll end up diagnosing it when they have their stroke, which is just not great medicine.
Absolutely. And there have been lots of knock-on effects, haven't there, of remote consulting and pandemics. But before we had that conversation, just before we started recording, I hadn't really fully appreciated the incidental pickup of atrial fibrillation. And not everybody has access to or wears a kind of watch or monitor or has something that can pick up anything that is abnormal or flag up anything that is abnormal. And so I guess it's important if you are feeling under the weather or if you are feeling fatigued to, you know, for us to have that degree of suspicion to arrange a tracing of the heart. And secondly, for, you know, if you listen to this and are aware of it, then to ask for it. Don't be afraid to ask for it.
And I guess that I've got a few things from my Instagram account. One thing is, if I could tell anyone, just be familiar with your pulse. Check your pulse, check your resting pulse. Is it regular? Is it normal rate? Is it fast or is it slow? It's so important to know your body. And I mean, women, we're reasonably good with breast awareness, and I think men with testicular awareness. But I think we should be introducing that as a feel your pulse. It's not, you know, it's not hard. Most people should be able to do it. There'll be helpful instructions on things like YouTube. So I think, yeah, being aware of your pulse is so important.
I think that's excellent advice. Yeah. And as a cardiologist, I 100% wholeheartedly support you on this. So yes, know your pulse. I think that's a really good message to take. And now, Kimberly, we've talked about so much. Thank you. You've been really honest and vulnerable, and you've shared. Okay. I have a couple more questions for you.
Yeah, of course. The end,
and I wanted to ask you, now, where you are in your position as a GP, as someone who's been through atrial fibrillation, as a woman in sport, what advice would you give your younger self?
I think I would love to have told myself, just to have more confidence and just be you. Don't be scared of being different. There's nothing wrong with being different. Embrace it. Don't try and fit in. Just be you. Be authentically you. And if people don't like it, that's not, you know, that's their problem, not yours.
I love that. I think that's wonderful advice.
Thank you.
What advice do you think your younger self would give you right now? Is there anything?
Oh, my younger self would probably just say, keep fighting, don't give up. I can't think of anything else.
Which is also great advice.
Yeah. Don't give up on what you love, I think, is what I would say to myself now. Yeah.
And what does the future hold now for you, Kimberly?
Oh, so many possibilities now, isn't there? What have I got coming up? I've got a husband versus wife triathlon in 2 weeks. That's my next event. Taking each other on. It's Leon's up 1-0, so I've got to really prove my point this time. So that's the next thing on the horizon. And then there's some swimming meets coming up in the next couple of months. So I think probably be focusing a bit more on the swimming for a little while.
Oh, well, good luck. Good luck. We'll be wishing you all the best. And where can people follow you on your journey?
So I only have Instagram because I think that's enough. So I am kimmy.b.try.
Wonderful. And we'll attach a link to that as well.
Thank you.
If anyone's interested, please do follow Kimmy. I 100% recommend it. It's an excellent account to follow. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your journey. I really thank appreciate you. That you came on today. Thank you.
No, it was lovely to come on. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening in. As I mentioned earlier, this is the last episode in this current season, but we will be back in September. If someone you know could find this episode helpful, then please do share. You can check out all the other episodes on our website, freshheartproject.com. We would be really grateful if you could comment, subscribe, and give this a 5-star rating. This helps us get the Fresh Heart message to more people. The content of this episode is not a substitute for medical advice from your healthcare professional. Remember, be kind to yourself, and small, sustainable steps create great change. This podcast is produced by Lion Mountain Entertainment, a subsidiary of Morgan Archway Limited.